Burton was a small, thin, dark-skinned man. He wore immaculately tailored suits and kept the thick, black curls of his hair and the small beard on his chin neatly groomed. That he worked in criminal enterprises said more about the world than about his character. With more opportunities, a more prestigious education, and a few influential dorm mates at upper university, he could have joined the ranks of transplanetary corporate executives with offices at Luna and Mars, Ceres Station and Ganymede. Instead, a few neighborhoods at the drowned edges of Baltimore answered to him. An organization of a dozen lieutenants, a couple hundred street-level thugs and knee-breakers, a scattering of drug cooks, identity hackers, dirty cops, and arms dealers followed his dictates, and a class of perhaps 1,000 professional victims, junkies, whores, vandals, unregistered children, and others in possession of disposable lives, looked up to him as he might look up at Luna, an icon of power and wealth glowing across an impassable void. A fact of nature. Burton's misfortune was to be born where and when he was, in a city of scars and vice, in an age when the division in the popular mind was between living on government-funded basic support or having an actual profession and money of your own. To go from an unregistered birth such as his to having any power and status at all was an achievement as profound as it was invisible. To the men and women he owned, the fact that he had risen up from among the lowest of the low was not an invitation, but a statement of his strength and improbability, mythical as the seagull that flew to the moon. Burton himself never thought about it, but that he had managed what he did meant only that it was possible. Anyone who had not had his determination, ruthlessness, and luck deserved pretty much whatever shit he handed to them. It didn't make him sympathetic when someone stepped out of line.
He what? Burton said.
Shot him, Oystra said, looking at the table. Around them, the sounds of the diner made a white noise that was like privacy.
Shot him.
Yeah. Austin was talking about how he was good for the money and how he just needed a few more days. Before he could finish, Timmy took that shitty homemade shotgun of his and...
Oystra made a shooting motion with two fingers and a thumb, the movement turning seamlessly into a shrug, a single gesture of violence and apology. Burton leaned back in his chair and looked over at Eric as if to say, "I think your puppy peed on my rug." Eric had recommended Timmy, had vouched for him, and so was responsible if things went wrong. It felt like they were going very wrong. Eric leaned forward, resting on his good elbow, hiding his fear with forced casualness. His bad arm, the left, was no longer than a six-year-old's and scarred badly at the joints. His disfigurement was the result of a beating he'd suffered as a child. It wasn't a fact that he'd shared with Burton, nor would he mention it now, though it did figure into the calculations that were his life, as did Timmy.
"He had a reason," Eric said.
"He did," Burton said, raising his eyebrows with feigned patience.
"And what was it?"
Eric's stomach knotted. His bad hand closed in a tiny fist. He saw the hardness in Burton's eyes, and it reminded him that even with his knowledge, even with his skills, there were others who could fake identity records, others who could fake DNA profiles, others who could do for Burton what he did. He was expendable. It was the message Burton meant him to take.
"I don't know," he said. "But I've known Timmy since forever, yeah? He doesn't do anything unless there's a reason."
"Well," Burton replied, pulling the word out to two syllables, "if it's since forever, I guess that makes it all right. Just, you know, if he did that, he did it for something."
Oystra scratched his arm, scowling to hide the relief he felt at Burton's focus turning to Eric.
"I got him in the storage room."
Burton stood up, pushing back his chair with the backs of his knees. The waitress made a point not to look at the three as they moved across the room and out through the doors marked employees only. Burton, and then Oystra, and Erich limping at the back. She didn't even start cleaning the table until she was sure they were gone. The storage room was claustrophobic to begin with and lined with boxes, making it even smaller. Cream-colored degradable storage boxes with flat green adhesive readouts on the side that listed what they contained and whether the cheap disposable sensors in the foam had detected rot and corruption. The table in the cramped open space at the center was pressed particle board, as much glue as wood. Timmy sat at it, the LED fixture overhead throwing the shadow of his brow down into his eyes. He was barely halfway into his second decade of life, but the red-brown hair was already receding from his forehead. He was strong, tall, and had an unnerving capacity for stillness. He looked up when the three men came in, dividing his smile equally among his childhood friend, the professional thug he'd just disappointed, and the thin, well-dressed man who controlled everything important in his life. "Hey," Timmy said to any of them. Erich moved to sit at the table, saw that Oystra and Burton were standing motionless, and pulled back. If Timmy noticed, he didn't say anything.
"I hear that you killed Austin," Burton said.
"Yeah," Timmy said. The empty smile changed not at all. Burton pulled out the chair opposite Timmy and sat. Oystra and Erich carefully didn't look at each other or at Burton. The object of all their attention, Timmy waited amiably for whatever came next.
"You care to tell me why you did that?" Burton asked.
"It's what you said to do," Timmy said.
"That man owed me money. I told you to get whatever you could from him. This was your tryout, little man. This was your game. Now, how do you go from what I actually said to what you did?"
"I got whatever I could get," Timmy replied. There was no fear in his voice or his expression, and it left Burton with the sense that he was talking to an idiot. "I couldn't get money out of that guy. He didn't have any. If he had, he'd have given it to you. Only thing you were getting from him was a way to make sure everyone else pays you on time. So, I took that instead."
"Really?"
"Yep."
"You're positive. You're convinced that Austin wouldn't have gotten my money."
"I don't mean to second guess why anybody gave it to him in the first place," Timmy said, "but that guy never met a dollar he didn't snort, shoot, or drink away."
"So, you thought it through, and you came to the conclusion that the wise and right thing to do was escalate this little visit from a collection run to a murder?"
Timmy's head tilted a degree.
"Didn't spend a lot of time thinking about it. Water's wet, sky's up.
Austin gets you more dead than alive. Kind of obvious."
Burton went silent. Oystra and Erich didn't look at him. Burton rubbed his hands together, the hiss of palm against palm, the loudest noise in the room. Timmy scratched his leg and waited, neither patient nor impatient. Erich felt a growing nausea and the certainty that he was about to watch an old friend and protector die in front of him. His stunted hand opened and closed, and he tried not to swallow. When Burton smiled his small, amused smile, the only one who saw it was Timmy, and if he understood it, he didn't react.
"Why don't you wait here, little man?" Burton said.
"All right," Timmy said, and Burton was already walking out the door.
Out in the cafe, the lunch rush had started. The booths and tables were filled, and a crowd loitered in the doorway, scowling at the waitresses, the diners who had gotten tables before them, and the empty place reserved for Burton and whoever he chose to have near him. As soon as he took his chair, the waitress came over, her eyebrows raised as if he were a new customer. He waved her away. There was something about sitting at an empty table in full view of hungry men and women that Burton enjoyed.
"What you want, I can take or I can leave," he said. "All I want is to keep your options
for myself. Eric and Oystra sat.
That boy,
Burton said, letting the words take on an affected drawl,
is some piece of work.
Yeah, Oystra said.
He's good at what he does, Eric said. He'll get better.
Burton was quiet for a long moment. A man at the front door pointed an angry finger toward Burton's table, demanding something of the waitress. She took the stranger's hand and pushed it down. The angry man left. Burton watched him go. If he didn't know any better, this wasn't the place for him.
Eric, I don't think I can take your friend off his probation period. Not with this. Not yet.
Eric nodded. The urge to speak for Timmy and the fear of losing Burton's fickle forgiveness warring in his throat. Oystra was the one to break the silence.
You want to give him another job?
The words carried a weight of incredulity measured to the gram.
The right job, Burton said.
Right one for now, anyway.
You say he watched out for you growing up?
He did, Eric said.
Let him do that then. Timmy's going to be your personal bodyguard on your next job. Keep you out of trouble. See if you can keep him out of trouble, too. At least do better than Oya did with him, right?
Burton said and laughed. A moment later, Oystra laughed, too, only a little sourly. Eric couldn't manage more than a sick, relieved grin.
I'll tell him, he said. I'll take care of it.
Do. Burton said, smiling. An awkward moment later, Eric got up, head bobbing like a bird's with gratitude and discomfort. Burton and Oystra watched him limp back toward the storage room. Oystra sighed.
I don't know why you're cultivating that freak, Burton's lieutenant said. He's off the grid, and he cooks good identity docs, Burton said. I like having someone who can't be traced keeping my name clean. I don't mean the cripple, I mean the other one. Seriously, there's something wrong with that kid.
I think he's got potential.
Potential for what?
Exactly, Burton said.
Okay, so tell me the rest. What's going on out there?
Oystra hoisted his eyebrows and hunched forward, elbows on the table. The kids running unlicensed games by the waterfront weren't coming up with the usual take. One of the brothels had been hit by an outbreak of antibiotic-resistant syphilis. One of the youngest boys, a 5-year-old, had it in his eyes. Burton's neighbor to the north, an earthbound branch of the Loca Griega, were seeing raids on their drug manufacturing houses. Burton listened with his eyelids at half-mast. Individually, no one event mattered much, but put together, they were the first few fat raindrops in a coming storm. Oystra knew it too. By the time the lunch rush ended, the booths and tables filling and emptying in the systole and diastole of the day's vast urban heart, Burton's mind was on a dozen other things. Eric and Timmy and the death of a small-time deadbeat weren't forgotten, but no particular importance was put on them either. That was what it meant to be Burton. Those things that could rise up to fill a small person's whole horizon were only small parts of his view. He was the boss, the big picture man. Like Baltimore itself, he weathered storms. Time had not been kind to the city. Its coastline was a ruin of drowned buildings kept from salvage by a complexity of rights, jurisdictions, regulations, and apathy, until the rising sea had all but reclaimed them for its own. The urban arcology movement had peaked there a decade or two before the technology existed to make its dreams of vast, sustainable structures a reality. It had left a wall 7 miles long and 20 stories high of decaying hope and structural resin that reached from the beltway to Lake Montebello. At the street level, electric networks laced the roadways, powering and guiding the vehicles that could use them. Sparrow's Island stood out in the waves like a widow watching the sea for a ship that would never come,
and Federal Hill scowled back at the city across shallow, filthy water, emperor of its own abandoned land. Everywhere, all through the city, space was at a premium. Extended families lived in decaying apartments designed for half as many. Men and women who couldn't escape the cramped space spent their days at the screens of their terminals, watching news feeds and dramas and pornography, and living on the textured protein and enriched rice of BASIC. For most, their forays into crime were half-hearted milquetoast affairs, a backroom brewer making weak, unregulated beer, a few kids stealing a neighbor's clothes or breaking their furniture, a band of scavengers with scrounged tools harvesting metal from the buried infrastructure of the city that had been. Baltimore was Earth, writ small, crowded and bored. Its citizens were caught between the dismal life of BASIC and the barriers of class, race, and opportunity, vicious competition, and limited resources that kept all but the most driven from a profession and actual currency. The dictates of the regional administration in Chicago filtered down to the streets slowly, and the local powers might be weaker than the government, but they were also closer. The gravities of law and lawlessness finding their balance point somewhere just north of Lansdowne. Time had not been kind to Lydia, either. She wasn't one of the unregistered, but very little of what was important in her life appeared in the government records. There she was a name, not Lydia, and an address where she had never lived. Her real home was four rooms on the fifth floor of a minor arcology looking out over the harbor. Her real work was keeping track of inventory for Leave, one of Burton's lieutenants. Before that, she had been his lover. Before that, she had been a whore in his stable. Before that, she had been someone else who she could hardly remember anymore. When she was alone, and she was often alone, the narrative she told herself was of how lucky she was. She'd escaped BASIC. She'd had dear friends and mentors when she was working. She'd been able to retire up in the ad hoc structure of the city's underworld. Many, many people hadn't been anywhere near as fortunate as she had been. She was growing old, yes. There was gray in her hair now, lines at the corners of her eyes, the first faint liver spots on the backs of her hands. She told herself they were the evidence of her success. Too many of her friends had never had them, never would. Her life had been a patchwork of love and violence, and the overlap was vast. Still, she hung warm-colored silk across her windows and wore the silver bells at her ankles and wrists that were the fashion among much younger women. Life, such as it was good. The evening sun hung over the rooftops to the west, the late summer heat thickening the air. Lydia was in the little half-kitchen warming up a bowl of frozen hummus when the door chimed and the bolts clacked open. Timmy came in, lifting his chin in greeting. She smiled back, raising an eyebrow. There was no one with him, and there never would be. They had never allowed someone else to be with them when they were together. Not since the night his mother died. So, how did it go?
Kind of fucked it up, me, Timmy said.
Lydia's heart went tight, and she tried to keep her voice calm and light.
How so? Burton told me to get what I could out of this guy. Looking back, I think he just meant money. So,
Timmy leaned against the couch, hands deep in his pockets, and shrugged.
Oops.
Was Burton angry? Timmy looked away and shrugged again. With that motion, she could see him again as he'd been as a young boy, as a child, as a baby. She had known his mother when they'd worked together, each watching out for the other when they turned tricks. Lydia had been there the night Timmy was born among the worn tiles and cold lights of the black market clinic. She'd made him soup the night Leave had turned him out the first time, and, while he ate, told him lies about her first time with a John to make him laugh. She'd picked music with him for his mother's memorial and told him that she'd died the way she'd lived, and not to blame himself. She had never been able to protect him from anything, so she'd helped him live in the jagged world, and he gave her something she couldn't describe or define, but that she needed, like a junkie craved the needle. "How angry is he?" she asked carefully. "Not that bad. I'm going to be watching Eric's back for a while. He's got some things need doing, and the boss doesn't want anything going pear-shaped, so that's all right." "And you? How are you?"
"I'm good," Timmy said.
"I think I'm coming down with something. Flu, maybe." She walked out from the kitchen, her food abandoned, and put the back of her hand to his forehead. His skin felt cool. "No fever," she said.
"Probably nothing," he said, pulling his shirt up over his head. "I got the shakes a little, and I got dizzy a couple times on the way back. It ain't serious."
"What happened to the man Burton sent you to?"
"I shot him."
"Did you kill him?" Lydia asked as she walked back to her bedroom. The ruddy light of sunset filtered through yellow silk. An old armoire stood against one wall, its silver finish stained and corroded by years. The bed was the same cheap foam queen-sized she'd had when she was working, the sheets old and thin, softer than skin with wear.
"Used the shotgun about a meter from his chest," Timmy said, following her. "Could have stuck your fist through the hole."
"So, yeah, pretty much." "Have you ever killed a man before?" she asked, lifting her dress up over her thighs, her hips, her head. Timmy undid his belt, frowning.
"Don't know. Beat some guys pretty bad. Maybe some of them didn't get back up, but no one I know about. You know, not for sure."
Lydia unhooked her bra, letting it slide to the cheap carpet. Timmy took his pants down, kicking them off with his shoes. He didn't wear underwear, and his erect penis bobbed in the air like it belonged to someone else. There was no desire in his expression, and only a mild distress.
"Timmy," she said, lying back on the bed and lifting her hips, "you aren't getting ill. You're traumatized."
"You think?" He seemed genuinely surprised by the thought, and then amused by it.
"Yeah, maybe.
Huh." He pulled her underwear down to her knees, her ankles.
"My poor Timmy," she murmured.
"Ah, shit," he said, lowering his body onto hers. "I'm all right. At least I'm not getting sick." Sex held few mysteries for Lydia. She had fucked and been fucked by more men than she could count, and she'd learned things from each of them. Ugly things, sometimes. Sometimes beautiful. She understood on a deep, animal level that sex was like music or language. It could express anything. Love, yes, or anger, or bitterness, or despair. It could be a way to grieve, or a way to take revenge. It could be a weapon, or a nightmare, or a solace. Sex was meaningless, and so it could mean anything. What she and Timmy did to and for and with each other's bodies wasn't a thing they discussed. She felt no shame about it. That other people would see only the perversion of a woman and the boy she'd helped raise, pleasuring one another, meant that other people would never understand what it meant to be them, to survive the world they survived. They were not lovers, and never would be. They were not surrogate mother and incestuous son. She was Lydia, and he was Timmy. In the bent and broken world, what they did fit. It was more than most people had. After, Timmy lay beside her, his breath still coming in small, reflexive gulps. Her body felt pleasantly tender and bruised. The yellow over the window was fading into twilight, and the rumble of air traffic was like constant thunder in the distance, or a city being shelled two valleys over. A transport ship for one of the orbital stations, maybe. Or a wing of atmospheric fighter planes on exercises. So long as she didn't look, She could pretend it was anything. Her mind wandered, delivering up what had been nagging at her since Timmy had told her all that had happened. Burton had sent Timmy to collect a debt. Timmy had killed the man instead, and Burton hadn't cut him loose. 2 points defined a line, but 3 defined the playing field. Burton didn't always have need of boys like Timmy, but sometimes he did. Right now, he did. Lydia sighed. The churn was coming. It was the name Leave had given it back before. All of nature had its rhythms, its booms and busts. She and Timmy and Leave and Burton were mammals. They were part of nature and subject to its rules and whims. She had lived through perhaps 3, perhaps 4 such catastrophes before, enough that she knew the signs. Like a squirrel gathering food before a hard winter, Burton collected violent men before the churn. When it came, there would be blood and death and prison sentences and maybe even a curfew for a time. Men like Timmy would die by the dozen, sacrificed for things they didn't know or understand. Maybe even some of Burton's lieutenants would fall the way Tanner Ford had back when she'd been Leave's lover. Or Stacy Lee before him. Or Cutbreath. The history of her corrupted world echoed with the names of the dead, the expendable, and the expended. If Burton had kept Timmy on, it was because he thought it was coming. And if Burton thought it was coming, it probably was. Timmy's breath was low and deep and regular. He sounded like a man asleep, except his eyes were open and fixed on the ceiling. Her own skin was cool now, the sweat dried or nearly so. A fly swooped through the air above them, a gray dot tracing a jagged path, turning and dodging to avoid dangers that weren't there. She lifted her first 2 fingers, cocked back her thumb, and made a thin, cartoon shooting sound with her teeth and tongue. The insect flew on, undisturbed by her small and violent fantasy. She turned her head to look at Timmy. His expression was blank and empty. He was still, and even in the warmth that followed orgasm, there was a tension in his body. He wasn't a beautiful boy. He'd never be a beautiful man. Someday, she thought, I will lose him. He will go off on some errand and he will never come back. I won't even know what happened to him. She probed at the thought, like a tongue tip against the sore gum where a tooth has been knocked out. It hurt, and hurt badly, but it hadn't happened yet, and so she could bear it. Best to prepare herself now. Meditate upon the coming loss, so that when it came, she was ready. Timmy's eyes clicked over toward her without his head shifting at all, without any expression coming to his face. Lydia smiled a slow, languorous smile. What are you thinking? She asked. He didn't answer. The catastrophe began 4 days later. Quietly, and with near military precision, the city opened a contract with Star Helix Security. Soldiers from across the globe arrived in small groups and sat through debriefings. The plan to end the criminal networks operating in Baltimore would be announced after the fact, or at least after the first wave. The thought, widely lauded by the self-congratulatory minds in administration, was to take the criminal element by surprise. In catching them flat-footed, the security teams could cripple their networks, break their power, and restore peace and the rule of law. The several unexamined assumptions in the argument remained unexamined, and the body armor and riot control weapons were distributed in perfect confidence that the enforcers would arrive unanticipated. In fact, what Burton and Lydia knew from experience, many, many others felt by instinct. There was a discomfort in the streets and alleys, on the rooftops and behind the locked doors. The city knew that something was near. The only surprise would be in the details. Eric felt it like an itch he couldn't scratch. He sat on the rotting concrete curb, drumming the fingers of his good hand against his kneecap. The street around him was the usual mix of foot traffic, bicycles, and wide blue buses. The air stank. The sewage lines this near the water were prone to failures. A few doors to the east, a group of children was playing some kind of complex game with linked headsets, their arms and legs falling into and out of phase with each other. Timmy stood on the sidewalk, squinting up into the sky. Behind them was a squatter's camp in an old ferro-concrete apartment block. In a locked room at its center, Eric's custom deck was set up and primed, connected to the network, and prepared to create a new identity from birth records to DNA matching to backdated newsfeed activity for the client as soon as she arrived. Assuming she arrived. She was 15 minutes late, and though they had no way to know it, already in custody. Timmy grunted and pointed up. Eric followed the gesture. Far above, a star burned in the vast oceanic blue, a plume of fire pushing a ship out of the atmosphere. Near the horizon, the half-moon glowed pale, a network of city lights crossing the shadowy meridian. "Transport," Eric said. "They use mass drivers for the stuff that can take the G's."
"I know," Timmy said.
"Ever want to go up there?"
"What for?"
"I don't know," Eric said, staring down the street for the client. He'd seen her picture, a tall Korean woman with blue hair. He didn't know who she'd been before, and he didn't much care. Burton wanted her made into someone new. "Piss out the window and make everyone down here think it was raining, maybe." Timmy's chuckle sounded polite. "It's what I'd do if I could," Eric said, making a swooping gesture with his good hand. "Zoom. Get up the well and out of here. Go where no one cares about who you are so long as you're good at what you do. Seriously, it's the wild fucking West up there. You want 19th century Tombstone, Arizona? It's alive and well on Ceres Station. From what I heard, anyway."
"Why don't you go then?" Timmy said. With a different intonation, it could have been dismissive. Instead, it was only a mild kind of curiosity.
It was part of what Eric liked about Timmy. There was almost nothing he seemed to feel deeply. "Starting from here, I'd never make it. I'm not even a registered birth."
"You could tell them," Timmy said. "People get registered all the time.
And then they get tracked and monitored and wind up dying on basic," Eric said. "Anyway, no one's taking me for a vocational. Waiting lists for that are 8-10 years long. By the time I came up, I'd have aged out."
"Could build one, couldn't you?" Timmy asked. "Make a new identity and put it at the front of the lists?"
"Maybe," Eric said. "If you gave me a couple years to layer it all in like I did for Burton. He can go anywhere with Doc's eye built for him."
"So? Why didn't you go then?"
Timmy asked again, his inflection as much an echo as his words. "Guess I don't want it bad enough. Anyway, I've got real stuff to do, don't I?" "I wish he'd fucking get here, right?" Eric said, unaware that he had made everything a question when he wanted to change the subject. Unconsciously, he made a fist with the hand of his bad arm. Timmy nodded, squinting down the street for the client that wasn't coming. Most of their lives had been spent on streets like this. The trade that exploited prostitutes and their illegal children was the second largest source of unregistered births in the city. Only religious radicals accounted for more. It was impossible to know how many unregistered men and women were eking out lives on the margin of society in Baltimore, or how many had lived and died unknown to the vast UN databases. Eric knew of perhaps 100 scattered among the legitimate citizens, like members of a secret society. They congregated in condemned buildings and squats, traded in the gray market economy of unlicensed services, and used their peculiar anonymity where it was most helpful. Looking down the pocked asphalt street, Eric could count three or four people that he personally knew were ghosts in the great world machine. Counting him and Timmy, that was half a dozen, all breathing the same air, while the plume of the orbital transport marked the sky gold and black above them. There was old water in the gutters, black circles of gum and tar on the sidewalk, the combined smell of urine and decay, and ocean all around them. Eric looked up at the sky with a longing he resented. He knew himself well enough to recognize that he was a man of desires and grudges, so well, in fact, that he'd come to peace with it. The blackness of space, where merit counted more than the placement on a bureaucrat's list, where the brothels were licensed and the prostitutes had a union, where freedom was a ship and a crew and enough work to pay for food and air. It called to him with a romance that made his heart ache. On Ceres or Tycho or Mars, the medical technology was available to regrow his crippled arm, to remake his shortened leg. The same technology could be found fewer than 8 miles from the filthy curb where he sat, but with the triple barriers of being unregistered, basic medical care waiting lists, and his own ability to function despite his disabilities, space was closer. Out there, he could be the man he should have been. The thought was like the promise of sex to a teenager, rich and powerful and frightening. Eric had resolved 1,000 times to make the effort, to build himself an escape identity and shrug off the chains of Earth, of Baltimore, of the life he'd lived. And 1,001 times, he had postponed it.
"Get up," Timmy said.
"You see her?" Eric said.
"Nope, get up."
Eric shifted, frowning. Timmy was looking east with an expression of mild curiosity. A casual witness at someone else's wreck. Eric stood. At the intersection, a block down, 2 armored vans had pulled to a stop. The logo on their sides was a 4-pointed star. Eric couldn't tell if the people getting out were men or women,
only that they were wearing riot gear.
Metallic fear flooded his mouth. Timmy put a strong hand on his shoulder and pushed him gently but implacably across the street. 2 more vans came to a halt at the intersection to the north.
"What the fuck?"
Eric said, his voice distant and shrill in his own ears. Timmy got him across the street and almost up to the doors of a 5-story squat before Eric pulled back.
"My deck, my setup. We've got to go back for it."
A deep, inhuman voice broke the air, the syllables designed in a sound lab to be sharp, clear, and intimidating.
"This is a security alert. Remain where you are with your hands visible until security personnel clear you to leave. This is a security alert."
At the intersection, teams of armored figures were already questioning 3 men. One of the civilians, a thin, angry man with close-cropped black hair and dark olive skin, shouted something, and the security team pushed him to his knees. The biometric scan, fingerprints, retina scan, fast-match DNA, took seconds while the man's arms were held out at his sides, his elbows bent back in restraint holds.
"I think maybe you used to have a deck," Timmy said. "I don't think you got one right now."
Eric stood unmoving, caught between the animal urge to flee and to protect himself by hiding the evidence. Timmy's thick fingers closed around his good shoulder. The big kid's expression was mildly concerned.
"We don't go right now. They're gonna have you and it both. I sort of screwed up the last thing Burton told me to do. Let's not burn my second chance getting you caught."
"This is a security alert. Remain where you are with your hands visible until security personnel clear you to leave."
Eric swallowed and nodded. It was the nearest he could come to speech. Timmy turned him toward the squat and pushed him forward. In the streets, the security teams converged slowly, moving from person to person, door to door, floor to floor. Before the operation was through, They would identify 343 people and detain four who appeared in the operational database as persons of interest. Three unregistered individuals would be identified, entered into the system, and held pending investigation. The two of the unregistered who refused to provide a name would have names assigned to them. The operation, covering three city blocks, would locate an unlicensed medical clinic, three children in distressed circumstances, 7 pounds of S-class psychoactives, 82 instances of illegal occupation, and the network interface deck and data collection setup offered up by a blue-haired detainee in exchange for a reduced penalty. The process would take 10 hours, and so it was still hardly underway when Timmy and Eric emerged from the undocumented access tunnel that connected the squat with an abandoned seawater pumping station. They walked together, Eric with his good hand stuffed deep in his pocket, Timmy with the same amiable air that was his default. Eric was weeping silently. Above them, the transport ship was gone, the golden exhaust plume now only a streak of smoke against the sky.
"I'm dead," Eric said. "Burton's gonna fucking kill me. They got my deck, they got everything."
"Wait a minute," Timmy said. "Everything, everything? Burton's stuff was on the—"
"No, I'm not stupid. I don't store records of how I keep Burton clean. But I didn't wash it down after the setup. I was going to do it after we were done. It's going to have DNA on it. Shit, it may even have fingerprints. I don't know."
"So what if it does?" Timmy asked with a shrug. "You're not in the system."
"Not now," Eric said. "But if they pick me up ever for anything, it's going to be with a little highlight alert linking back to that fucking deck. They'll know what I do. And then they'll know to ask."
"You don't gotta say anything," Timmy said, his tone almost apologetic.
"I won't get a chance. Burton finds out they've got my DNA, all he's gonna see is a path back to him. I'm a loose end, man, I'm dead."
All around the city, traps shut. In the north, 5 dozen armored security personnel blocked intersections and shut down metro stations. The door-to-door search and control operation converged on a 7-story office building controlled by the local Griega. The local men and women took shelter where they could, hiding in bathtubs and basements and soot-caked hard brick fireplaces, things dense enough to hopefully block the infrared and backscatter and heartbeat sensors Star Helix carried. Network signals went dark. The Star Helix employees moved forward in tight formation, forced to use their eyes instead of their tech, the plates of armor on their chests and backs and bellies making them seem like vast beetles in the autumn sunlight. When the perimeter around the building was established, monitoring stations were constructed, watching the windows for the vibrations made by voices. A wave of dragonfly small surveillance drones swept in, and for a moment it seemed like perhaps the violence wouldn't come. And then, as one, the hundreds of small, cheap Star Helix robots fell to the ground, victims of local Griega countermeasures, and the building bloomed with gunfire. 17 local Griega died before the sun went down, including Edward Hopkins and Johanna Zurban, reputed to be the Earth's surface coordinators of the belt-based syndicate. The plume of smoke that rose from the building darkened the air for hours and left the city air gray and hazy the next morning. At the same time, in the west, where the municipal limits gave way invisibly to the regional jurisdiction, a warehouse owned and operated through a complex web of shell companies was locked down. The security teams emptied a 3-block radius using a small fleet of armored buses and an operational procedure designed for response to sarin gas attacks. When the warehouse's perimeter was breached shortly before midnight, it contained 10,000 unrecorded assault rifles, 500,000 rounds of tracer-free ammunition, 70 cases of grenades, and a computer room ankle-deep in melted slag. There was no evidence of anyone having been present in the warehouse, and no trail of ownership for any of it. Checkpoints at the evacuated rail terminal, the spaceport, and the docks identified 70 people traveling on falsified accounts. All of them were independents, or small fry in a larger organization. The security forces hadn't expected to catch anyone high on their priorities list in the first pass. The more powerful, better-connected targets were either smart enough not to travel during a crackdown, or else had cleaned accounts to move under. Instead, the thought was that among the small-time thugs and operatives, there might be one or two desperate and foolish enough to provide them a lead to someone bigger, someone worth having. And so, without knowing who Burton was, what he looked like, his name or description or precise role in the criminal ecology of Baltimore, they were hunting him. And they were also hunting others, many of them much higher priority than himself. Organizasi Bayo had a presence in the city, as did the Golden Bough. Tamara Sludin controlled several blocks north of the arcology, and Bazin Tagnichin, an area twice Burton's, though not so profitably run, in the Patapsco Valley housing complex. There was a great deal of crime, organized and otherwise, for the forces of law to concern themselves with, and no net was so strong or fine that nothing slipped through. In times like these, when he couldn't know whether he had been compromised, Burton played it safe. He had half a dozen apartments and warehouses outfitted to act as temporary command centers, and he moved between them almost at random. Some of his people, he knew, would be caught up. Some of those who were would buy short-term leniency with the coin of information. He knew that would happen, and he had plans in place that would protect him from discovery, obscure his involvement in anything actionable, and punish brutally and irrevocably whoever had chosen to make that trade. It was understood that anyone captured would be wiser to trade their own underlings to the security forces than to sell out Burton. The risk devolved on the little guy. Shit rolling downhill, as it had since the beginning of time. Which was, in part, why what happened to Leave was so unfortunate for everybody. Leave Andropoulos had worked for Burton since coming to Baltimore from Paris more than 20 years before. He was a thickly built man, as round in the chest as the belly, and strong enough that he rarely had to prove it. His appetite for women occasioned jokes, though rarely the sort made in front of him, as did his habit of placing his long-term lovers in positions of comfort within his organization when he ended their relationships. As one of Burton's lieutenants, he oversaw three full-time whorehouses, a small network of drug dealers specializing in low-end narcotics and psychoactives, and an unlicensed medical facility that catered to the unregistered population. By custom, he worked from a small concrete building at the edge of the water. But when the churn began, he was leaving his lover's apartment on Pratt. The woman's name was Katie, and she had the olive skin and brown lips that Lydia had had 20 years before. Leave was a man of habits and consistent tastes. He kissed her goodbye for the last time on the street outside the apartment building, then walked away to the north while she went south. It was a perfunctory gesture, meaningful only in retrospect, as so many last kisses are. The streets were crowded, the air muggy and close. The salt water and rotting fish smells of the encroaching Atlantic were omnipresent, as they always were on hot days. Private transport wasn't allowed, and the lumbering buses moved like slow elephants in the press of midday bodies. A beggar plucked at Leave's sleeve and then backed away in fear when Leave turned to scowl at him. In the cacophony of the city, the whine of the flying drones should have been inaudible, but something caught Leave's attention, tightening the skin across the back of his wide neck. His footsteps faltered. From above, the ripples in the crowd would have looked like the surface of still water disturbed by the convergence of a half a dozen fish intent on the same fly. For Leave, it was only a sense of dread, a burst of useless adrenaline, and the offended shouts of the civilians pushed aside by the armored security men. As if by magic, a bubble of open space appeared around him. Leave could see clearly the scuffed and stained concrete on which he walked. The man in the Star Helix uniform before him held a pistol in both hands, the barrel fixed on Leave's chest, center of mass, by the books. Behind the helmet's clear face shield, the man looked to be somewhere in his middle 20s, focused and frightened. Leave felt a pang of amusement and regret. He held his arms out at his sides, cruciform, as five more security men boiled out of the gawking crowd. "Leave Andropoulos," the boy shouted. "You are under arrest for racketeering, slavery, and murder. You are not required to participate in questioning without the presence of an attorney or union representative." Tiny flecks of spittle dotted the inside of the face shield. The boy's wide eyes were almost jittering with fear. Leave sighed.
"Ask me," he said slowly, enunciating very clearly, "if I understand."
"What?" the boy shouted.
"You've told me the charges and made the questioning statement. Now you have to ask me if I understand."
"Do you understand?" the boy barked, and Leave nodded.
"Good, better," Leave said. "Now go fuck yourself."
The prisoner transport blatted its siren, shouldering its way through the crowd. But before it had crossed the distance to Leave, before he had been slotted into the steel cell and made secure, news of his capture was radiating out through the neighborhood. By the time the transport began moving again, making its way north toward the nearest tactical center, Burton had already seen a recording of the arrest. Katie, sitting at a noodle cafe with her little brother, got the news on her hand terminal and broke down weeping. Dread passed through the network of Leave's employees and underlings. Everyone knew what would happen next, and what would not. Leave would be taken to a holding cell, processed and interrogated. If he kept quiet, he would be remanded to state custody, tried, and sent to a detention center, likely in North Africa or the west coast of Australia. More likely, he would cut a deal, parting out the network of crime he'd controlled bit by bit in exchange for clemency, the names and ID numbers of his pimps in order to serve his time in North America or Asia, the details of how he laundered the money for a private cell, which physicians had moonlighted in his clinic for library access. They would ask him who he worked for, and he wouldn't say. For Burton's other lieutenants, it complicated the future and simplified the present. One of their own was gone and unlikely to return. When the worst had passed and something like normalcy returned to Burton's little kingdom, business that had been Leave's would be shared among them, granted to some newly promoted member of the criminal nobility or a combination of the two. How exactly that played out would be the subject of weeks of negotiations and struggle. But later. Later. In the short term, all such agendas gave way to the more immediate problems of avoiding the security forces, protecting the assets they had, and making it very clear to everyone under them that selling out information for the favor of the court's mercy was a very, very bad idea. In a basement lab at the corner of Lexington and Green, 80 gallons of reagents used in alkaloid synthesis were poured into the water recycling system. At the locally renowned Boyer Street House, two overly talkative prostitutes went quietly missing, and the doors were locked. The body of Mikhail Batman Chanduri was discovered in his two-room apartment at sundown, and though it was clear his death had been violent and protracted, none of his neighbors had anything to report to the security men who'd come to interview him. Before the sun had set, Burton's lieutenants Cyrano, Oystra, Simonson, Little Cole, and the Ragman went to ground like foxes, ready to wait out the worst of the crackdown, each hoping that they would not be another gap in the organization like Leave, and each hoping that the others, not all, of course, but a few, would. One or two, perhaps even three, harbored some plots of their own, ways to see that their rivals within Burton's organization fell prey to the dangers of the churn. But they didn't speak of them to anyone they didn't trust with their lives. And in an unlicensed rooftop coffee bar that looked down over the human-packed streets, Erich hunched over a gray market network deck the owner had bolted to the table. He was trying to keep his panic from showing, wondering if Burton had heard about the capture of his deck, and hoping that wherever Timmy had rushed off to when they'd learned of Leave's arrest, he'd get back soon. The coffee was black and bitter, and Erich couldn't tell if the coppery flavor was a problem with the beans or the lingering taste of fear. He sat on his newsfeed, set to passive for fear that his search requests would be traced, and watched as all around him more traps snapped shut, his gut knotting tighter with every one. When Lydia heard what had happened to Leave, her first action was to put on her makeup and style her long, gray-streaked hair. She sat at the mirror in her bedroom and rubbed on the flesh-toned base until the lines in her skin were gone. She painted her lips fuller and darker and redder than they had ever been in nature. The black eyeliner, reddish eyeshadow, rust-colored blush. Despite the danger she was in, she didn't hurry. A lifetime of experience had drawn connections in her mind that linked sexual desirability, fear, and fatalism in ways she would have recognized as unhealthy if she'd seen them in someone else. She pulled her hair around, piling it high and pinning it in place until it cascaded, three quarters contained, to her shoulders in the style Leave had enjoyed back when he had lifted her up from the working population of the house and made her his own. She thought of it as a last act of fidelity, like dressing a corpse. She shrugged out of her robe and pulled on simple, functional clothes, running shoes. Her go-bag was a nondescript blue backpack with a three-month supply of her medications, two changes of clothes, four protein bars, a pistol, two boxes of ammunition, a water bottle, and $3,000 spread across half a dozen credit chips. She pulled it down from the top of her closet and, without opening it to check its contents, went to the chair by her front window. The curtains were pale gauze that scattered and softened the afternoon light, graying everything. She pulled a sheer yellow scarf over her hair, swathed her neck, and tied it at her sternum, the ironic echo of her old hijab. Then sat very still, feet side by side, ankles and knees touching. Primly, she thought. She waited in silence to see who would open her door. A security team, or Timmy, the darkness, or else the light. The better part of an hour passed. Her spine hurt, and she savored the pain, keeping her face placid. Smiles or grimaces, either one, would disturb her makeup. Then, footsteps in the hall, like someone clearing their throat. The door opened, and Timmy stepped in. His gaze flicked down to her back, up to her face. He shrugged and nodded to the hall in a gesture that said, "Can we go?" as clearly as words. Lydia stood, pulled on her pack as she walked to the door, and left her room for the last time. She had lived there for the better part of a decade. The necklace that Leave had given her the night he'd told her he was moving on, but that she would be cared for, hung from a peg in the bathroom. The cheap earthenware cup that Timmy had painted with glaze when he was 8 years old and given her for what he'd mistakenly thought was her birthday remained in the cupboard. The half-finished knitting that an old roommate had left when she disappeared 20 years before sat hunched in a plastic bag under the bed, stinking of dust. Lydia didn't look back. "My spirit animal is the snake," she said as they walked south together. They went side by side, but not touching. "I shed my skin. I just let it slough away." "Okay," Timmy said. "Come on this way,
I got a thing waiting.
The waterline was cleanest near the new port. There, the ships and houseboats rested in clean slips made of flexible ceramic, and the bones of the drowned buildings had been cut free and hauled away. With every mile farther from the port, the debris grew less picturesque, the charm of the reclaimed city giving way to the debris of its authentic past. Little beaches formed over asphalt, gray sand swirling around old blocky concrete pillars, standing in the waves green with algae and white with birdshit. The stink of rot came from the soupy water and the corpses of jellyfish melting where the tide had left them. Timmy's boat was small. White paint flaked off the metal where it hadn't been scraped well enough before being repainted. Lydia sat in the bow, her legs folded under her, her chin high and proud. The motor was an under-the-waterline pulse drive, quiet as a hum. The water in their wake was louder. The sun was near to setting, the city casting its shadow on the waves. A handful of other boats were on the water, manned by children for the most part. The citizens of Basic, with nothing better to do with their time than spend the twilight on the water, then go home. Timmy ran them along the coast for a time and then turned east, out toward the vast ocean. The moon had set, but the lights of the city were bright enough to travel by. The islands had once been part of the city itself, and now were ruins. Timmy aimed for one of the smaller, a stretch not more than 2 city blocks long by 3 wide, humped out of the water. A few ancient walls still stood. The boat ran up onto the hard shore, and Timmy jumped out, soaking his pants to the thighs, to pull it the rest of the way up. The metal screeched against the rotting concrete sidewalk. The ruin he led her to was little more than a campsite. A bright yellow emergency preparedness sleeping bag lay unrolled on a foam mattress. An LED lamp squatted beside it with a cord snaking up the grimy wall to a solar collector in the window. A small chemical camping stove stood on a driftwood board placed over 2 cinder blocks, a little unpowered refrigerator beside it to store food. 2 more rooms stood empty through the doorway. If the house had ever had a kitchen or a bathroom, it was lost in the tumble of rubble beyond that. Outside, the city glowed, the violence and bustle made calm and beautiful by even such a small distance. The wail of the sirens and angry blat of the security alerts became a kind of music there, transformed by the mystical act of passing above waves. Timmy pulled off his water-soaked pants and dug a fresh pair out from under the sleeping bag. "This is where you go?" Lydia said, putting her hand on the time-pocked window glass. "When you aren't with me, you come to this?"
"Nobody bugs you here," Timmy said. "Or, you know, not twice."
She nodded, as much to herself as for his benefit. Timmy looked around the room and rubbed his hand across his high forehead.
"It's not as nice as your place," he said, "but it's safe. Temporary."
"Yes," she said. "Temporary."
"Even if Leave does tell him about you, it's not like it's over. You can get a new name, new paper."
Lydia turned her gaze back from the city, her right hand going to her left arm as if she were protecting herself. Her gaze darted to the empty doorway and then back. "Where's Eric?"
"Yeah, the meet didn't happen," Timmy said, leaning against the wall.
She never ceased to be amazed by his physicality, the innocence and vulnerability that his body managed to project while still being an instrument of violence. "Tell me," she said. And he did. All of it, slowly and carefully, as if worried he might leave something out that she wanted to know, that she found interesting. The low rumble of a launch shuddered like an endless peal of thunder, and the exhaust plume rose into the night sky as he spoke. It had not yet broken into orbit when he stopped.
"And where is he now?" she asked.
"There's a coffee bar," The one at Franklin and St. Paul? On top of the old high-rises there? I got him there when it was done. They've got a deck there you can rent by the minute, and since his got taken, I figured he'd like that. Gotta say, he was pretty freaked out. That DNA thing? I don't see how that's gonna end well, if he's right about how Burton's gonna react.
Lydia shook her head once, a tiny gesture, almost invisible by the light of the single LED lamp.
I thought you were his bodyguard. You were assigned to protect him.
I did, Timmy said.
But then the job was done.
Burton didn't tell me I was supposed to go to the bathroom with him for the rest of his life, right? Job was done, so the job was done.
I thought you were his friend.
I am, Timmy said. But, you know, you.
Don't worry about me. Whatever comes to me, I have earned it 1,000 times over.
Don't disagree with me. Don't interrupt. Burton asked you to protect Eric because Eric is precious to him. The particular job he assigned you may be over, but worse has come to the city, and Eric is still precious.
And I get that, Timmy said.
Only when they got leave,
I have lived through the churn before, darling boy. I know how this goes.
She turned to the window, gesturing at the golden lights of the city.
Leave was only one. There will be others, perhaps many, perhaps few, but Burton will lose some part of his structure to the security forces or to death, and the ones who remain afterward will become more important to him. He is a man who values survivors, who values loyalty. What will he think, dear, when he hears that you left Eric to come spirit me away?
Job was done, Timmy said, a little petulantly, she thought.
Not good enough, she said. Not anymore. You aren't the boy Eric drinks with anymore. You aren't even your mother's son now. Those versions of you are gone, and they will never come back. You are the man who took a job from Burton.
Timmy was silent. Far above them, the transport's exhaust plume went dark. Lydia stepped close to him and put her hands on his shoulders. He wouldn't meet her eyes. She thought that was a good sign, that it meant she was getting through to him.
The world changes you, and you can't stop it from doing so. You have to let go of being someone who doesn't matter now. Because if you live through this time, just live through it and nothing more, you will be more important to Burton. You can't avoid it. You can only choose what your importance is. Will you be someone he can rely upon, or someone he can't?
Timmy took a deep breath in through his nose and sighed it out. His eyes were flat and hard.
I think I may be fucked up again.
Only maybe, Lydia said. There still may be time to repair the error, yes? Go find your friend. You can bring him here.
Timmy's head jerked up. Lydia rubbed his shoulders gently, beginning at the base of his neck and stroking out to the bulges of muscle where his arms began, then back again. It was a gesture she had made with him since he was a child, a physical idiom in their own private language. Her heart ached at the sacrifice she was making. The world changes you, she thought. Hadn't she just said that?
Bring him here? You sure about that?
It's all right, she said. It's temporary.
Okay then, he said.
She felt a tug of regret that he had given in so quickly, but it passed quickly.
I'll leave you the good boat.
The good boat? She said to his retreating back.
The one we came in.
The door closed. The gray that passed for darkness swallowed him up, and 5 minutes later she heard what might have been a skiff splashing in among the waves. Or it might only have been her imagination. She pulled herself into the warm, stinking, plastic embrace of the sleeping bag and stared at the ceiling and waited to see whether he returned.